Good morning and welcome to the August 3rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
We're going to spend the morning talking with Michael Pollack. He's the author of Sidewalk Nation, The Life and Law of America's Most Overlooked Resource. There's a lot more going on in sidewalks than I realized. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Michael coming up right after this. The humble sidewalk is something that we all walk over but rarely think about. It's constantly taken for granted, yet linked to nearly every pressing issue of local governance in urban, suburban, and even rural areas. From commerce, taxes, and property rights to policing, homelessness, surveillance, from free speech and socioeconomic equity to public health and climate resilience. Michael Pollack is a professor of law at the Cardozo School of Law and the author of Sidewalk Nation, The Life and Law of America's Most Overlooked Resource. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Michael, and thanks for joining us on Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you, guys.
Okay, let's take a walk. What motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
So, you know, I live in New York City. I spend a lot of my time walking, but it was really, I was the kind of person who took that for granted. I think most people take that space beneath our feet for granted as we go about our daily lives, whether it's in big cities like New York or smaller towns all over the country. But it was really for me during the height of the pandemic, you know, now over 6 years ago, where like a lot of folks, I spent a lot of time taking walks around the neighborhood for exercise, socializing with friends and family, going to businesses that were doing dining and bars and shopping on the sidewalk. And I thought, gosh, there is so much life happening here. And so I really started to, you know, pay more and more attention to it. And what I found in both life and in research is that vibrancy, that life was always there and still is there now. You know, it was obviously a more dramatic time, a more dramatic period for that kind of use. But it really opened my eyes to see what I had been missing all this time. And, you know, I'm a law professor. I teach and write about property law and local governments and the management and regulation of space, especially public space. So this was a natural place for me to start looking and see, well, how are we managing this space and all of these vital uses? And could we be doing it any better?
You know, for someone who hasn't thought about this much, you might think, okay, sidewalks are something that probably came up with the advent of the automobile as a safe way for people to walk by the side of the street. But historically, that's not a very accurate perspective, is it?
That's right. We've had sidewalks for centuries. There are sidewalks in the ruins of Pompeii. There are sidewalks on the European continent since long before colonists came over to the United States. Some of the earliest sidewalks here were in New Orleans, and it was a French colony, in Manhattan, and it was a Dutch colony. So we've had sidewalks for a really long time. Now, our relationship with them and the uses that they serve, that's certainly changed over time, and one of the stories I get into in the book. But this resource has been a vital part of our cities and our towns for basically forever.
You traveled to over a dozen cities and towns. How did you choose those locations, and what were you looking for in each one?
So the book takes us to New York, Texas, Louisiana, and Colorado, and multiple cities and towns in each state. What I was trying to do there is capture a range of types of places, a range of climates, of politics, of sizes and cultures and uses. You know, I think of New York City, I think a lot of folks do, as sort of the sidewalk mecca, and that's probably true in terms of the amount of use and the amount of life that takes place there. You know, I wanted to go to Texas because I think a lot of folks have the impression, and as I explain in the book, it's a misimpression, but have the impression that Texas is just about cars and no one wants to use bikes or walk on the sidewalk or anything like that. So I wanted to explore whether and to what extent that was true. Louisiana was an opportunity to really talk about the risks of flooding and stormwater, basically a sinking city, and how that physical infrastructure relates to all the other uses. In Colorado, you know, right next door to you guys, tells a very interesting story because in 2022, voters in Denver took a really bold step and voted in a referendum to change how sidewalks were funded and maintained. And so I wanted to tell that story and research some of the roles of local democracy and local participation in sidewalks. like I said, I was aiming for capturing a lot of diversity, but one of the things I found that I think is really important is there's a lot more similar than there is different. You know, what all these cities and towns engage with and have to deal with when it comes to sidewalk life and sidewalk law, yeah, there are absolutely, you know, local variations, but a lot of same stories, a lot of the same obstacles, the same difficulties. That means that there's actually a lot that we can learn from each other all across the country in terms of how our different places are dealing with very similar problems.
In New York, for example, you sort of contrast different communities, Manhattan versus what you saw in upstate. Talk a little bit about the similarities and differences that you found interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously one of the big differences is just size, right? Big, big cities have a lot more people and a lot more commerce and a lot more tourism happening on the sidewalk. Take New Orleans, Mardi Gras parades, right? A lot more social life taking place on the sidewalks. In smaller towns that are, you know, have neighborhoods that are purely residential, there, to the extent there are sidewalks and to the extent they're being used, it's mostly for people, you know, going for a jog, walking their dog. Sometimes, you know, you'll have Girl Scouts selling cookies or kids selling lemonade or things like that. And then there's, you know, the middle, right? So you've got small towns, medium-sized suburbs, they have a downtown core, perhaps, right? The sort of commercial part of the town. And that's that they've got sidewalks there, and folks are using those for the same wide range of stuff that's happening in a big city, just on a smaller scale. You know, so I think one of the biggest differences is scale. Another is sort of attitudes or cultural feelings toward the sidewalk. In some places, in some neighborhoods within cities, in some towns, sidewalks read as a really valuable amenity, a really important thing for community life and community commerce. In other communities, they read as a sign of something more urban or suburban in a community that might want to feel more rustic or rural. And so you see sometimes opposition to the expansion of a sidewalk network from folks who want to, you know, keep a certain way of life or a certain sort of visual sense of their community. There's a lot to be said for that. There's also a lot to be said going the opposite direction. As much as that might feel good, if you're a part of a larger city and the rest of that city uses and needs sidewalks for people to get from place to place, well, then the consequence of one neighborhood, you know, trying to essentially opt out means that A, their residents can't get up to other places and folks can't get to them. And sometimes that's the point. But it also means that people can't get through the neighborhood. And, you know, depending on where it is and how big it is, that can be a real connectivity problem. Sidewalks really are a network. They work best as a complete network. And when you've got missing links, especially at a whole, you know, neighborhood level, that can be really damaging for the entire city.
I want to back up just for a second to the cities and towns you traveled to. Which of those places most surprised you about the way they manage sidewalks in both a positive light and a negative light?
Well, the good news is I didn't get a lot of unexpected negative light. I think one of the messages of the book is that there is really high demand for sidewalks and walkability and that all of the community benefits that it brings all throughout the country, regardless of partisanship or location or wealth or any of those sort of factors that we might expect would drive some differences. You know, I think there are places that are doing a better job and a worse job meeting that demand. You know, one of the most common flaws that I see in how cities and towns take care of their sidewalks is by placing the financial responsibility for doing so on the property owners who happen to live next door to the sidewalk rather than on the city itself. And that is common across a lot of the cities and towns that I study, including New York City, where I live. And that's something that I think really needs to change. That's what Denver changed, as I was alluding to earlier, and I'm happy to talk more about that. But in terms of places that are doing it really well, and maybe in an unexpected fashion, for me, it's primarily Georgetown, Texas. So this is a small town outside of Austin. Small town's probably underselling. It's a small city outside of Austin. And they have done a just remarkable job of fostering a really great sort of core downtown set of sidewalk, not only set of sidewalk, you know, physical concrete, but set of laws and policies that foster real engagement in life there. And one of the big things that they did that I think more cities and towns can learn from is make a concerted effort to move a lot of the parking just outside of that downtown core. Street parking, and especially parking lots, are one of the big obstacles that I've noticed to effective and vibrant sidewalk life. Houston, for example, has a lot of sidewalk, and a lot of it is in quite good shape, but people aren't really using it very much. And among the, you know, many complicated reasons for that, one of them is that sidewalks are separated from every destination by a giant surface parking lot. What Georgetown did is essentially take that away, move the parking lot a little bit out of the downtown core. So you end up with a real sort of small town feel in a bigger city. And you walk around there and there is a ton of commercial and personal and community sidewalk use. So I think that's one of the big lessons I learned, just how interconnected law and policy choices, like, for example, where do we put our parking? Do we have laws requiring the building of parking lots or not? Those kinds of decisions affect what goes on with our sidewalks too.
And, you know, you mentioned, you know, Denver. And, you know, obviously Colorado has this reputation for this rustic outdoor mountain life scene. But talk a little bit about the way Denver has approached sidewalks.
Yeah. Like I was saying before, Denver, like many cities, had required the adjacent property owner to pay to maintain the sidewalk, to clear the snow and the ice off the sidewalk, in some cases even to install the sidewalk in the first place if there wasn't any. This is an enormous financial burden on property owners, and worse, it's kind of an unexpected burden. For one thing, a lot of property owners don't realize they have that fiscal responsibility, but even if they do, they don't know when it's going to be triggered. You know, the city's going to take a look and decide, okay, now the sidewalk is in bad enough shape, it needs to be fixed, and they're going to tell the property owner, you have to do this. Sometimes they'll say, okay, you can pay us, the city, and our contractor will deal with it. Or here's a list of approved contractors. You can hire them and pay to have this fixed yourself. I interviewed the former mayor of Ithaca, New York, for my book, Svante Myrick, and he sort of called this sidewalk roulette. I thought that was a great phrase, right? Mm-hmm. That property owners didn't know when their turn would be, when the bill would come due for them. And that's a real problem for anyone trying to, you know, plan a household budget. It's also really inequitable because it means that folks with less money are less able to take care of the sidewalks in their community. And so you see, generally, the quality of sidewalks in less wealthy communities being less good. And that's particularly problematic because it's often those same individuals, those same communities that are most reliant on sidewalks to get around, to get to their jobs and to school, because they don't have as many private cars to own. So Denver, not led by top-down government, but rather bottom-up grassroots organizers, worked together to advance a voter referendum to say, okay, going forward, instead of this being this traditional system of private property ownership and private property owner responsibility, we're going to shift responsibility for public space, like sidewalks, to where it belongs, the public, and fund that out of a generally applicable fee imposed on property owners, a flat fee for residential owners, a slightly higher one for commercial property owners. And that money would be gathered from all across the city and devoted into or dedicated into a specific pot for sidewalk maintenance and sidewalk network expansion. And that proved to be popular enough to pass. And it's now been a couple of years of designing and implementing it, but it's getting off the ground right now. And it's going to be a much more effective way of taking care of sidewalks equitably and efficiently. Ithaca has done the same thing in upstate New York. But I think this is one way that cities can really make valuable strides towards making this resource work as effectively as possible for as many people as possible.
As I was reading this, this notion that this thing in front of my house, which certainly looks like it should belong to the city, it certainly acts like it should belong to the city, is imposed on me as an owner to shovel the sidewalk. And in some cases, I actually own it, and there's an easement over it. In some cases, I don't own it, but I still have this obligation. How did this get started? How did we get here?
You know, there's not really a great satisfying answer to that question. And to me, that's all the more reason we should change it. There's never been a really sophisticated legal justification for this. As you were saying, it's either purely public property, in which case we never make private individuals care for specific public property, right? We care for that through our tax dollars and other shared resources. And even when the sidewalk is private or sitting on private property, as you were saying, and there's a public easement over it, property law principles tell us that it is the responsibility of the easement holder to take care of their right of access and the land they use for that access, not the underlying property owner. So either way, this really ought to be a public responsibility. Like I was saying before, since the 1800s, this has often in many cities been a private responsibility, largely justified simply because, well, it's easier this way. And of course, when we say that, we mean easier for the government this way, not for the individual. You know, and look, there is something to be said for that, especially when it comes to snow removal, right? The property owner is right there. They can take care of it, maybe, arguably, more quickly than the city can. At least that was probably the case in the 1800s, before the advent of machinery and technology that a city could deploy to do it much more easily. I argue in the book that I think even snow removal should become a municipal responsibility, at the very least in some of the most major thoroughfares where there's the most traffic. But, you know, that's something that most cities have not gotten to yet. I'll wait my turn to get there on that policy move. But when it comes to actually repairing the sidewalk, there really is, in my mind, no justification for this. It is simply a matter of the city finding it convenient to offload this financial responsibility onto somebody else. A lot of property owners, you know, might go years without having to pay for it. And from their perspective, again, if they don't know this could ever happen, sounds like a pretty good deal. They get free sidewalks and never have to pay for it at all. The problem is someday the bill comes due for all of us. And, you know, like I was saying before, especially when that's unpredictable, that can be a real problem. Better to be proactive, right? Have a city actually get out there, inventory what their state of the sidewalk is, what their network looks like, where repairs need to take place, you know, sooner rather than later and so on. And then have a centralized set of resources to go out to deploy to make those repairs. Sometimes I talk about this and city officials or voters are, you know, hesitant or concerned or think we can't afford that. It's too much. What I say to that is that's exactly what we do for the roads, right? What I'm describing is exactly how we take care of our roads when there's a pothole or it needs to be repaved or what have you. It would be ridiculous, I think, to suggest the neighboring homeowners should go out and repave the road or plow the street when it's been, you know, covered in snow. People would revolt at that idea. And yet we treat the sidewalk exactly that way. And I think too often people are sort of okay with that, or maybe they just haven't dared to think that it might be different, that there could be a better way. And that's part of what I want to try to bring attention to in this book. Not only is that there could be a better way,
but there is.
But that there is, and cities and towns are actually doing it right now.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with author Michael Pollack about his new book, Sidewalk Nation.
You know, another issue that popped out to me, the first one was sort of focusing on this weird obligation of the property owner with the sidewalk. But another one that popped out to me was just how many entities have some regulatory authority over sidewalks. I mean, it was incredibly complicated. I think it was in the first chapter about New York. You go through this department as this department as that. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, one of the things I'm most critical of in the book is this private ownership responsibility. The other is exactly this, is just how fragmented and fractured responsibility for sidewalks is within city governments. Now, this is especially true in big cities. So, as you said, Roger, in New York City, for example, we've got the Department of Transportation that, you know, arguably takes some of the lead and some of the aspects of the physical, you know, repairs and the physical state of the sidewalk. But you have sanitation, because we put our trash out on the sidewalk. You have environmental protection. You have various business licensing agencies and health health code enforcement agencies, for the restaurants and the shops that are doing sidewalk dining. You have mental health and hygiene and homeless services, fire, police. I tell a brief anecdote in the book about if a sidewalk cafe wants to have a candle on the table at their restaurant, they not only need a permit from the various business licensing agencies, they also need a permit from the fire department to have that open candle on the table. And I'm not saying that's wrong. You know, that sounds like a good safety measure to me too. But when you're trying to think from the perspective of that restaurant or that business or that residential property owner, the red tape, the sort of thicket of bureaucracy that I have to navigate, and I don't necessarily know from the start who's the right agency to go to, right? Because they all have this overlapping and multi-jurisdictional responsibility. Not only are there overlaps, there are also gaps, right? When you've got all of these different cooks in the kitchen, A, you have too much attention arguably on one thing, but maybe everyone thinks someone else is handling this aspect of the space, and it turns out nobody is, and it's fallen through the cracks, and no pun intended there. But, you know, there's this risk of both duplicative and under-enforcement. You know, what I want to see is more coordination, perhaps even more consolidation. One of the big arguments I make is for what I call a Department of Sidewalks, something and an agency in, especially in big cities, that would not add to the bureaucratic architecture, but streamline it, take over pieces of the sidewalk puzzle from all the other agencies that currently have some sort of toehold into it, and put it all in one place so that there'd be a one-stop shop for permits and regulation, and so that there'd be one set of officials who sort of have the 360 view on all of the uses, all of the things that are happening there, to make sure that they're being done in a coordinated and sort of mutually reinforcing fashion rather than a ultimately destructive fashion where each of the uses sort of undermines all the others.
You mentioned sanitation. Am I correct that you actually write in the book that they're finally going to make people in New York put their bags of trash into a container? If so, that's a really big step forward.
It's a huge step forward. It's, you know, New York City has finally joined the rest of the world in discovering that there exists such a thing as a garbage can. It's a remarkable invention. So yes, we've already begun containerizing trash. Recycling will be next. Now, we have not quite yet gotten to the point of centralized containers like a lot of cities have, but that's something that I know that Mayor Mamdani has been working on. Mayor Adams was, you know, making some starts in that direction as well. So hopefully in the long run, that could be a real game changer for sidewalk life, especially it's the height of summer right now. It smells when it's really hot, oh, yeah. Right? So that could be a real game changer just in terms of life on the sidewalk being more pleasant. You know, at the same time, though, I want to be a little bit cautious. Those containers could also just take up space on the sidewalk. And that itself is another feature to be careful about in terms of where are those going to go? Is the sidewalk wide enough for it? Are we putting it at a spot on the block where we don't need that space for other things? You know, should it be put in a place where it can, we can afford to have that space be taken up by a trash container without making the sidewalk inaccessible or unusable for other uses? Which naturally leads to the more politically controversial question of, should those containers be on the sidewalk or should they be curbside in what is currently a parking space? Obviously, I think the answer is yes. That's exactly where they belong, so that we could have our sidewalks be totally usable for everything else that we ask of them. But obviously, parking spaces are a hot button political issue here in New York City, as I'm sure they are in most cities.
Your discussion on vending on sidewalks is fantastic. Can you talk about the history of commerce on the sidewalk?
Yeah, so, you know, sidewalks have also been sites of commerce forever. People would sell fruits and vegetables, you know, meats, cheeses, sandwiches. You know, we have in New York City, the hot dog vendors, the pretzel vendors, the, you know, hot nuts vendors. But that's been a thing for centuries as well. Now, it's always been politically controversial. A large part of the reason why is that a lot of vendors have, for most of American history, been immigrant populations, right? So in Los Angeles, for example, it was a lot of Asian immigrants and a lot of the xenophobia and racism against those immigrant populations manifested in hostility to the vending. And so cities spent a lot of time trying to crack down on sidewalk vending to either require very expensive permits or to corral it into certain neighborhoods where, in the city's mind, quote unquote, belonged. Another source of hostility has been brick and mortar businesses that view the vendors as competition, right? If I own a restaurant and there's a food truck that's, you know, allowed to be a vendor right on the sidewalk, that's, I view that as competition. Now, there's also a restaurant next door to me that's competition too, but there's a different attitude toward that because at least they have a similar set of overhead costs, whereas the food truck doesn't. And so that's where I view it as competition. You know, now we also, it's less of the hostility now to vending comes from xenophobia toward immigrant populations, but there's a lot of vending done by unhoused individuals. And so a lot of the hostility toward vending and populations of people experiencing homelessness coalesce or at least intersect. Even if you could sort of take away the, whatever the bigotry that might have motivated some of these concerns, these are still concerns in the same way that the trash bags are a concern or that the sidewalk cafes are a concern, that every use of the sidewalk is a concern. It could be a good thing. It could be a good thing in the wrong place. It could be a bad thing. And it's really hard to know at a general level what those categories are, right? Every use of the sidewalk is plausibly appropriate. And so it's really a political priority question about which ones do we want to have where? And I think for too long, A, that decision has been spread across too many agencies, as we've just been talking about. But B, we haven't really been thinking about that question framed that way, right? Instead, we think about, okay, vending, yay or nay, or, you know, homelessness, yay or nay. And it's much more complicated than that. It's really a question of where and how, not yes or no. And part of what I want to do is try to get not just government officials, but, you know, regular folks to see, as you were saying at the in the intro, Roger, that there is every issue of policy that, you know, might matter to an individual, that might matter to a city, has a sidewalk component to it. And conversely, regulating the sidewalk better helps us find solutions to so many other big picture problems.
You know, as you go through the book, you start thinking more about these different sort of potentially conflicting uses. For example, talk a little bit about sort of, we've talked about vendors, but they're also, sidewalks are being used by delivery persons. Sidewalks are being used by, as I was walking the streets in Europe last week, there were scooters on the street that you could, that were just left there for people to rent. How do you balance those conflicting use demands?
You know, and as you were saying before, right, there's a certain attitude toward vendors from, you know, neighboring businesses or property owners that's different than an attitude toward, quote unquote, commercial uses, right? And I mean sort of incorporated, fancy, high scale commercial uses. But at the same time, when my point is that they're actually the same thing, you know? So you've got companies like you were mentioning that do scooter rentals, Lime, Bird, Lyft scooters. In many cities, they, you know, people just leave the scooter on the sidewalk wherever they're done using it. And sometimes that's because the city has not regulated it to prohibit that kind of thing, or they haven't worked with the private company, or the private company hasn't worked with them to you know, make that happen, to have them be more organized. Some cities have been doing a better job. Boulder, Colorado, Lime is their sort of official scooter partner, and they have what they call Lime Groves, very clever, a sort of lime green painted rectangle on the sidewalk periodically where people are meant to park the scooter. And Lime uses sort of geofencing technology to make sure that the scooters are in fact put in those places by either penalizing or locking out users that don't park them in the appropriate place when they're done. So, you know, there are solutions to these sort of commercial clutter problems on the sidewalk. Cities and their private partners just need to, you know, do something about it and actually make those into law, or at least into the rules and terms and conditions of the thing. You know, the other thing you didn't mention is delivery robots. I think that's one of the biggest sort of hurdles for the future, for the near future at least. More and more companies, whether it's, you know, food delivery or you know, Amazon had piloted them. So at FedEx, they had sort of shelved those pilots, but that those might come back. These are, you know, either remote controlled or autonomously driven robots that, you know, go down the sidewalk to make deliveries of food or packages. In theory, it's a great idea, but they take up space. They're, you know, especially on a narrow sidewalk, they can take up the entire width of the sidewalk. They don't always behave predictably, you know, all of the problems of any sort of autonomous technology at this stage, right? It can be a real problem for folks in wheelchairs if the robot gets stuck or stopped because they can't navigate around it in the same way that, you know, a person on 2 feet might be able to. So there are some challenges, but you could also look at it as an opportunity because cities, A, might need, as I was saying before, more information about the quality of their sidewalk network. And one effective way to get that is to partner with these delivery robot companies to do some of mapping of the terrain as they go about their deliveries. The company needs that information too to build a map for the robots to work with. It's not hard to share that information at the same time, gather data on where did the robot struggle with the elevation change or a pothole or something like that. And so cities might leverage the permit to operate in exchange for this kind of data sharing partnership. Cities could go further and, you know, charge the companies for the privilege of having that permit and operating, and then use the revenue from that permitting fee into sidewalk maintenance. So, you know, I think there are a lot of ways that cities can look at these, you know, commercial outfits, these, especially the ones, you know, piloting new technology, use them as opportunities to try to get something that the city needs rather than just as either something to ban or something to just sort of let do its thing with no regulation, no oversight.
Okay, so you address issues like ADA compliance. We just mentioned the wheelchair and the robot, disabled persons access, homelessness, outdoor dining. Has ADA advanced sidewalk accessibility? And what are the obstacles or failures if it hasn't?
Yeah, so yes and no. You know, the ADA is an enormous legislative achievement that really can't be undersold, but it's, by its terms, limited, right? So one of the things that the, well, let's start from the beginning. One of the things that the ADA says is that the cost of compliance, the cost of building accessible facilities can, in some circumstances, be a justification for not doing it. And in other circumstances, it's not a justification. In that first category, where cost is a permissible legal justification for not achieving accessibility, that's where you see a lot of failures to achieve accessibility because it is true that sidewalks are expensive. Sidewalk repairs are expensive. Sidewalk accessibility is expensive. And cities, you know, cities everywhere, budgets are tight. And there's a lot of things that we need to spend money on, or at least want to spend money on. And sometimes you can see, I can see, where a city does run into a legitimate obstacle to achieving accessibility. So at the same time, cities do overstate this quite a bit. And sometimes once they get sued, magically they find the money and the work gets done. You know, I have been told, I have heard off the record from some officials that sometimes they even, I don't want to say welcome the lawsuit, but there's a political benefit to the lawsuit because it gives the city officials some cover to spend the money on the accessibility changes that need to happen and not other things that, you know, their voters might want to prioritize. And so, you know, I cautiously, I guess, want to say, file those lawsuits. You might even have a sort of receptive city on there, or at least not a very unhappy city on the other end. But regardless, you know, these are your rights. And so you should file these lawsuits to advance and protect your rights, right? And hopefully get the changes that need to be made. The thing that I am most concerned about when it comes to accessibility is not just the attention to the physical terrain of the sidewalk. You know, I think folks are sort of pretty attuned to curb cuts, and we need to have curb cuts that are at a good slope and that are safe. And that's true and correct. And I think that's where a lot of the progress has been made. But too often I have seen examples of pristine, beautiful, smooth curb cuts at the corner, and then a totally rocky, chopped up, uneven sidewalk beyond it. That's also an accessibility problem, and perhaps even a bigger one. And even beyond the terrain, there's all those other uses, right? So sidewalk dining, I think, is a really great thing, but it limits the width of the sidewalk. And like I was saying before, if you're not careful about where you put the trash receptacle and the dining permitted space and the advertising sign and the lamppost and the bus stop, suddenly there's not enough room left for anyone to get through, especially folks with disabilities. Now, the ADA doesn't allow that, right? There are rules about this kind of thing to require a certain width for passage, but with all these uses taking place, and some of them being not permanent uses, it can sort of be very easy for violations to slip through the cracks. And that goes back to my bigger point earlier about we've got to be more careful about not letting things slip through the cracks. And that's, again, because we need someone who can look at all of those uses rather than take them one at a time.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with author Michael Pollack about his new book, Sidewalk Nation. Now, where does the law stand on homeless living on the sidewalks?
You know, so that's obviously a major policy issue in so many cities and towns. And it's a major policy issue in a bunch of different directions. You know, there's obviously folks who just are and have antipathy toward homeless populations. There's folks on the other, you know, end of the spectrum that, you know, just want things to be better for them. And, you know, I count myself among the latter. I really want things to be better. The question is, how do we do that, right? How do we make things be better? Not just for those populations, but for everyone else who is trying to make use of the sidewalk. And sort of as I was saying before, folks sleeping on it or living on it are another use that, you know, again, is not implausibly appropriate, but takes up space and has these sort of negative spillover effects for other uses. And so it's just like any other use. We need to think about where does it belong? How do we regulate it? Under what conditions? And so on. And as I was saying before about parking, you know, similar kind of thing here. We need to think bigger about the intersection between all different policy choices and these sort of sidewalk effects. I think too often cities and towns think of homelessness as a sidewalk problem, and therefore the solution is remove them from the sidewalk, right? And remove them where? Often into jail. And policing as a solution to homelessness doesn't work, hasn't worked, and therefore we shouldn't really have that be our primary approach anymore. I'm for doing things that work, and I'm for not doing things that don't work. And this, we've tried this for decades, hasn't seemed to be very effective. But when you think about what other policy choices could we make that would address this problem and contribute to more vibrant sidewalk life, or at least safer sidewalk life, well, one of them is building more housing. Right? Building not just more affordable housing, but more supportive housing, more mental health housing, more drug treatment housing. And doing these things requires making some changes to other areas of law, like zoning law. This is a separate and, you know, now a very big conversation in a lot of cities, is revisiting what have been very restrictive zoning rules that only allow very low density housing or even only single family housing in large portions of cities and towns. You know, we have an affordability crisis in this country at all levels of the economy. You know, everyone is struggling right now to buy groceries and afford a place to live. And building more supply is the best way of lowering the price. And that's going to be valuable for everybody, but that has an effect far, you know, the farther down the income chain that you go. And if you really are thoughtful and careful about building housing, not just affordable market rate housing, but housing that is geared toward this particular population, that can have a lot of benefits for the entire community, right? It gets that population off the streets into stable housing that's safer and better and healthier for them. And it solves the problem of the sidewalk that we were talking about. So, you know, Denver has made some very good strides in this regard. The mayor has this House 1000 program that he's, you know, been re-upping to expand the supply of not just what we call affordable housing, but tiny homes, accessory to dwelling units or ADUs, right? Other forms of housing that could really be accessible to and achievable by this population that could really, you know, have these broader systemic effects on the homeless population and on the city at large.
You know, you talked a few minutes ago about this image of a pristine curb cut leading to a rocky sidewalk. As I was reading the first part of the book, one of the things that struck me that I hadn't really thought about was the variance in width and the variance in nature of sidewalks. And you talk about something called a Hollywood sidewalk, which, as I understand it, is not in fact very glamorous.
That's right. You know, so a sidewalk is not a sidewalk everywhere, right? They vary in quality, in width, in terrain, or even in this extreme example, perhaps, is it even a sidewalk at all? So the Hollywood sidewalk is something that I encountered in Denver. No one could really explain to me where the name came from, why it's called a Hollywood sidewalk. I don't really have a good answer to that. But it's not really a sidewalk in my mind. It is a glorified curb, right? It is a slightly wider curb, and it's usually on an angle. And what it does is it helps with snow melt and runoff and drainage, right? It sort of angles the water into the gutter and out to a storm drain, and that's great. But it doesn't really function as a sidewalk in the sense of being a flat, even place that a person could walk or roll a wheelchair or do anything else for that matter. And so, you know, when you think about, okay, does my block have a sidewalk? It's sort of, the question is deeper than that. It's, okay, what kind of sidewalk does my block have? Is it functional in this place? You know, and in some places in Denver, the Hollywood sidewalk is doing its job. And there, you know, much more isn't really needed. It's a very low traffic area. There's not a lot of people walking around or cars driving around. It's pretty safe to walk in the street. And it's fine. You know, there's not a lot of commerce happening. It works fine. In other parts of the city, that would be wholly inappropriate for the demands being put on the space there. So this is, again, my point about we need to be very context specific. One size fits all rules about, you know, every part of every city has to have sidewalks be the same. No, there should be some minimum standards, especially for accessibility. But other than that, we do need to be careful about making things be appropriate for the particular space, the particular topography, as well as whatever the sort of culture and economy and uses are in that place.
We've talked a bit in the last few minutes about the benefits of sidewalks, how they contribute to life, how they are a vehicle for commerce. Have you done any analysis of the costs, the economic costs of failing to have sidewalks? In other words, the other side, of the other half of the glass, which might be half full.
It's such a great point, you know, because we talk all the time about, oh, it would be so expensive to install this sidewalk. It would be so expensive to have it be repaired and taken care of well. You know, and all of that, it's true. That thing, you know, things cost money. You know, I talk in the book about where that money might come from. But I think you make a really important point. Doing nothing also has costs, right? It's not the case that having bad sidewalks is free or contributes money to a community. Rather, it deprives the community of the economic opportunities of, you know, whether it's sidewalk dining or vending. It deprives the community of window shopping, you know, that the sort of happenstance kinds of commerce or just human interaction that take place. And it lowers property values. You know, there is plenty of data that indicates that not just in the sort of coastal cities where everyone likes to walk, but nationwide, homes with access to walkable communities net a premium on the housing market. Redfin has a walk score on every home for sale, and homes with higher walk scores sell for more money. I've read recent survey data suggesting that close to 80% of Americans say that they want to live in a more walkable community. And almost all of those people further report that they're willing to pay more for it. So depriving people, not offering a walkable community, is depriving people something that not only they want, but that they're willing to pay for. Mm. So we're leaving money on the table here as communities, and to invest in our sidewalk infrastructure would not only improve the business environment, but would also raise property values, therefore raise property tax revenue, and enable cities to have more resources to not only pour back into their sidewalks, but into so many other, you know, critical civic functions.
I want to go back to the beginning where sidewalks were around 1,000 years ago. Now, there weren't cars. Maybe there were horses. running around. Why would you need a sidewalk instead of a big open dirt road?
Well, so one of the problems of the sidewalk when there were no cars was the horses, because, you know, compared to horses, cars are in some ways a whole lot cleaner. You know, there's horse waste on the streets, and you know, if you read your history of you know the early America, you know, cholera and you know stagnant water running on the gutter, the sidewalk was a place to stand where you weren't standing in all of that muck, right? Now, to your point, though, people weren't really using them very much at the beginning to get from place to place. They were often viewed primarily as an amenity for a particular property, right? So this saloon or this house would have a sidewalk in front of it so that once a person, you know, hitched up their horse, they could get out, stand on the sidewalk instead of in the muck, and then enter that building. And that history of the sidewalk being so closely associated with a benefit for that property is probably where we get a lot of the legacy of the property owner responsibility for the sidewalk, right? Is that it was initially a thing that that owner benefited from. And so it made sense in some way for them to be the one to take care of it. It's just that it's been hundreds of years since that's really been what our sidewalks have been for. Yeah. And the law hasn't caught up to that.
You know, you touched on something that I never really thought about, many things that I never really thought about, but one in particular was, I'm reading along and all of a sudden there's this discussion, I think it was in New Orleans, about the relationship between sidewalks, tree cover, and climate change. Can you talk a little bit about that one?
Yeah, so this is something that is especially acute in New Orleans and Florida, other parts of our country that are really low-lying, but parts of it are problems everywhere. So trees are great. Trees are pretty. They provide shade, which cools the street and cools the sidewalk and makes it a healthier and better place to be. Trees oxygenate the community, which is also really important for health and just enjoyment of being outside. But trees are bad for sidewalks because they have roots, and those roots, as they grow bigger, lift up the concrete, crack the concrete, and cause a lot of inaccessibility and just trip hazards, right? That's a problem everywhere. New Orleans has a whole other degree of this problem because, A, they have these huge, very old trees. It's a big part of what New Orleans is sort of famous for. But at the same time, as they have the tree roots that are lifting up the sidewalk, the city is sinking into the Gulf. And so as the subsidence sort of eats away at the terrain underneath the sidewalk and the trees push the sidewalk up, you just get this increasing gap between the ground and the sidewalk as the ground falls and the sidewalk is lifted. And it makes these trip hazards and this unevenness that much more dramatic. Now, the climate change part of it all is, you know, as we all know, New Orleans faces a lot of severe weather, hurricanes, flooding, and that's being amplified and increased with climate change. To keep the city from flooding, there's a very complex system of levees and pumps that remove water out of the city and pump it into Lake Pontchartrain. But those pumps, as they pump out the groundwater beneath the city, further contribute to the subsidence of the city, right? It's like the city's sitting on a sponge, and when the sponge is full, it's taller and it can hold the city up, but that's bad because the sponge gets saturated and then there's flooding. So the city needs to constantly wring out the sponge to absorb more water, but every time they wring out the sponge gets smaller and the city sinks down. And so they're caught between this, you know, push and pull of we need to keep the city dry, but we also need to keep the city afloat. And every measure they do to keep it dry makes it harder to keep it afloat. Now, that's obviously a huge policy problem and environmental problem with so many implications. The sidewalk is just one of them, right? But it's a very visible one, right? You walk around, you drive around, you can see it. And I think, you know, we need to have these visible reminders of what is at stake here and what the forces we're contending with are. And so, you know, sidewalks in small ways can help us actually fight climate change. They can provide us, if they're designed right, with more absorbent surfaces, if you sort of fold in trees and plants and rock and gravel to absorb stormwater, they can be really valuable in that respect. To the extent they promote walkability, they can also just cut down our reliance on fossil fuel emitting cars and things like that. But they're also a sort of canary in the coal mine of the climate crisis, right? Seeing the ways that the sidewalks are collapsing or breaking in a city like New Orleans reminds us just how vulnerable we are to these forces.
Before we go, I know that you referred earlier in the interview to what you would like to see in terms of what I would call a unified regulatory structure for sidewalks. Talk a little bit more about how you would fix this problem.
Yeah, so, you know, I want to bring all of the private responsibility out of private hands and into government hands. So I want to put folks like you and me out of the sidewalk management and sidewalk maintenance business. I don't think we're very good at it. We certainly can't afford to do it all the same and all equally well. So I want to have that be a government responsibility, like I was saying, just like the roads are. And just like Denver and Ithaca and other places have been making that move, Lexington, Kentucky, another one recently. And then within government, I want to streamline what we already have. So consolidate all of these sort of spread out regulatory functions into one home where property owners and business owners, they know exactly who they have to talk to, who they need to apply to permits, who they need to apply to for permits. This is a one-stop shop for them. And on the other side, where there's one agency that really can take that wide angle lens, see all of the uses of the space, all of the competing forces that shape it, and that's accountable for managing it. You know, one of the things that's, I think, a problem right now is folks don't really know who's to blame for sidewalk problems, because the answer is often a lot of different people. And I think it would be really valuable if folks knew which commissioner was the sidewalks person. Then they would be able to demand more, expect more, hold government more accountable. And ultimately, that's how we can get a much better sidewalk for all of us and for all the uses we put on it.
The book is Sidewalk Nation, The Life and Law of America's Most Overlooked Resource. We've had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Michael Pollack this morning. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, guys.